Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast for Connecting Faith. And remember, there are even more shows available on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for tuning in. Good to have you along. We've had a wonderful weekend. Boy, the summer is kind of racing by, is it not, RT?
It's in bloom, but it's going so quickly.
It does feel like it's the 23rd of June. Of course, we're officially into summer now, finally. So welcome to summer.
It's good to be here with you.
Yes. Did you experience joy and excitement for the longest day here?
Yes. I believe that I was walking next to a lake when it occurred,
okay.
And I felt very happy to be alive.
Yeah. This our long days of daylight are wonderful here in the Upper Midwest when the weather's nice. Nothing quite like the long days that our guest today experienced.
No.
Floating out in the middle of the South China Sea.
Unbelievable.
Without a paddle, as it were, or a sail or anything like that.
Unbelievable. Looking forward to it.
It is quite a story, and we're just going to simply spend some time hearing a story today. Hope that you can just sit back and relax and enjoy and be reminded of God's direction and providence in spite of challenges that come our way and your challenges and mine, probably not quite in comparison to what the Vinh Chung experienced. Vinh was born in South Vietnam just 8 months after it fell to the communists in 1975, and we'll learn a little bit more about his family. They were wealthy and involved in business enterprises there, but within months of the communist takeover, the Chungs lost everything, and they were reduced to poverty, and they ended up fleeing, became one of many boat people, and that's kind of we're going to take the story. Eventually, it came to the U.S. In fact, Vinh is talking to us today from Colorado Springs, where he and his wife, Leslie, have four children, run a successful private medical practice. And we are honored to talk with him. He, along with Tim Downs, has written his story, a memoir called Where the Wind Leads, a refugee family's miraculous story of loss, rescue, and redemption. Vinh, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's really a privilege.
I've enjoyed the story. By the way, I should mention, too, for our those that are listening, we do have a copy of Vinh's book that we'll do a drawing for. If you're looking for some good summertime reading, this would be great, if you're at the lake, or I don't know if you're out on the South China Sea. I don't know if I want to read it there, but it would be. it's a fascinating story, Where the Wind Leads. We have a copy, so you're welcome to give us a call and sign up for that at 877-93-FAITH. We'll do a little drawing at the end of the hour, 877-933-2484. Vinh, as we just mentioned the story a little bit, a large family, born in Vietnam, and you were just a little guy when the family decided that it was time to go.
That's right. So I was only 3.5 years old, and so this story is actually one that is based upon the collective memory of my parents and my siblings and me. And it's a story that spans three generations across two continents. And it's a story of rags to riches and then back to rags and then how we became Americans and now have a greater wealth than we could have ever imagined.
You, I'm sure that in the process of maybe going back to write this story, maybe I'll ask you about why you decided to write it, but you probably discovered that you had a similar journey. I mean, there were thousands of quote-unquote boat people at the time, right?
That's right. And so, I'm a dermatologist, so that's my profession. I've never thought of writing a book before, but then I shared this story about 2 years ago at a World Vision conference, and after that, so many people came up and told me that my story needs to be told. And after several phone calls and then being paired up with Tim Downs, 2 years later, we now have a book. And it's really a story that is, although my family is from Vietnam, it's a story that is consistent with what we know about the American story.
You didn't have any really awareness of America, I suppose, at the time. Did you? Was that the idea that somehow you would flee Vietnam and you would get to America? Or what was your family's thinking? Maybe talk a little bit about that part first.
That's right. So the one thing that we pointed out in our book was the concept of a refugee compared to an immigrant. An immigrant is someone who leaves a country with a plan and a destination in mind for somewhere they can aim to arrive. A refugee, which is what my families were, we were forced to leave, and we really had nowhere that was ready to welcome us. Because of persecution, because we didn't have a future, we were forced to leave. And our goal when leaving Vietnam was that we would make it to a refugee camp where we could stay and hope to be granted asylum to really any country across the world.
So you were born in Vietnam. Of course, South Vietnam fell back in 75, but your family were successful. You had the sort of family-run business in, rice milling? I mean, you were, by all accounts, doing quite well, right? How did that change, and why did it change?
That's right. So after the communists took over in 1975, we were targeted for two reasons. One is because we were wealthy. The communists did not like any wealthy people because, in their minds, the wealthy merchant class were the root of all problems. The other strike against us was that we were ethnic Chinese. And there were some tensions between Vietnam and China at this point. And so that's what led to our fleeing the country, because we were targeted because of who we were before the Vietnam War.
And did you think about trying to make your way to China? I mean, I know that many others tried to do that, right? Go back to some more ancestral heritage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when we were leaving, we tried, we had considered, or at least my parents had considered, all the options, including staying in Vietnam. Because if we stayed in Vietnam, at least we knew that we wouldn't die, but we knew that that wasn't how we wanted to live. And so they looked at their children, and they decided that it was better to risk dying out at sea than to stay behind in communist Vietnam. And we knew at this point that hundreds of thousands of people were fleeing on rickety boats, would sell everything, get out in the sea, and just hope to make it to a refugee camp in one of the surrounding countries. So that was the route that we took.
You said rickety boat and selling everything. I mean, those are a couple of key phrases there. Maybe just to explain a little bit more about what that was really like. I mean, that'd be hard for us to imagine trying to set sail in a major ocean in what you went out in.
That's right. So once someone decided to leave Vietnam, it was really a one-way ticket. You had to pay the local government to get a pass to leave. They also, we didn't have access to airplanes or any space to bring any of our belongings. So everything that we had to sign it back to the local government and leave it there, our property, whatever little we had left that they hadn't already taken. We then sold everything and converted to jewelry or gold and left with whatever we could carry in our pockets.
Which, of course, corruption is sort of a universal issue. That just because you had signed up for a boat didn't mean you could actually get on the boat without paying more, right?
That's right. And so corruption was rampant. And anytime there is a vulnerable group of people, such as the refugees, there are people in position of authority or power who would take advantage of us. So, yes, we expected that along the way, whenever we encounter any local officials, we were ready to pay them just so that we can leave the country. And once we left the country, we were then at the mercy of the wind and the tides that would just take us whichever direction it would. At the same time, we were at the mercy of the Thai pirates that were preying on the boat people at this time.
And they were, in fact, really pirates, right, out of Thailand. Right?
Yeah. That's right. So, you know, the local Thai fishermen discovered that it was a lot easier to make money robbing refugees than fishing, because they knew that when we left Vietnam, we brought everything, literally everything that we owned, converted into jewelry or gold, and we were we had helpless children on board, and we were not soldiers. We were basically defenseless people floating in these boats that, in their mind, were probably floating bank vaults.
And talk a little bit about the boat that you were on, and how many people. Just sort of give us a sense of what that was. I mean, you were on a couple of boats, but I guess the first time out.
That's right. So you know, the first boat that we left on, it was a boat with 290 people, and these are 290 refugees that crammed, you know, back to back. It was a back to back. And each person, you know, was allowed to literally just carry whatever they could have in their hands. And this boat that left Vietnam actually made it to Malaysia. There we hoped to be admitted to a refugee camp. But by this time, the Malaysian government has closed its doors to the boat people. And so our group was then divided into four smaller groups, placed in little fishing boats, and then towed out to sea and left to die. The little fishing boat that my family was on was crammed with 93 people. It's a little dilapidated boat that wasn't even working. And it's a boat that you could probably, you know, design for six people or so, but we were packed in there like sardines, all 93 of us.
With no oars, no motor, no sail, no food or water, right?
That's correct. Yeah, no food, no water, no way to move in any direction, and so we're just drifting aimlessly for days on end.
Out in the South China Sea, we're going to pick up the story in just a moment. More with Vin Chung, telling his story in the memoir called "Where the Wind Leads." It's a refugee family's miraculous story of loss, rescue, and redemption. I guess you can figure out that there's rescue in there, but we're going to find out how that happened and some of the amazing work of the World Vision in the process and how they found their way to America eventually. And we'll hear more about what God has done in the life of Vin Chung and their family, which is, among other things, some, what, 20-something, I think, that have a degree. It's a pretty amazing story. So it's you'll be encouraged and want to listen for more as we talk with Vin Chung coming up here in a moment on Connecting Faith. Story today. Vin is, he's now graduated Harvard, magna cum laude, attended Harvard Medical School for his MD, studied at the University of Sydney as a Fulbright Scholar, and completed a Master's of Pharmaceutical Sciences. He also holds a Master of Theology from the University of Edinburgh and currently serves on the board of World Vision U.S. You wouldn't know that his story picked up in the middle of the South China Sea when he was under 4 years old, 93 people crammed in a rickety old fishing boat with no means of moving around at all, simply left to drift. He's told the story in the new book called Where the Wind Leads, and it's from Thomas Nelson, and it's a great reading. And so Vin is out there with his family, or at least many family members, and packed in this little boat with nothing going on. You and, as you mentioned, thousands of others, boat people, World Vision, at that time, Stan Mooneyhan was leading World Vision, and there was some concern that we simply can't just let all these people be left to the wind and to the pirates, because many did, in fact, perish, right, from these journeys.
That's right. So the actual number of people who died escaping Vietnam as boat people, we really don't know, but we estimate it to be hundreds of thousands, and roughly 50% of people who left as boat people didn't make it.
So you're out there, no food, water. I mean, I guess, you know, we could talk about how your family sort of got miraculously, your mom at least got miraculously reconnected with your family, because you did land in a camp in Malaysia, or they put you on the beach, right?
That's right. So when our large group of 290 people made it to the beach in Malaysia, we were essentially imprisoned on the beach there and forced to march around. On the beach, my mother suffered a miscarriage and almost died. And we were rejected from a refugee camp and placed into four smaller rickety boats that were not functioning, and towed out to sea and left to die.
Tell us about the World Vision, this sea sweep, and you know what you have discovered about that intervention.
That's right. So it's really an incredible story that hinges on the obedience of one man, Stan Mooneyhan. It was during this time when hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese boat people were fleeing, and the entire world has essentially turned its back on the suffering refugees. But Stan Mooneyhan learned about the crisis of the Vietnamese boat people, and his heart was just broken, and he just couldn't say no to the needs. And so he and a group of others launched Operation Sea Sweep, where they bought a boat, came out into the area where the refugees were fleeing to offer us assistance. And it was there that they came across the boat that my family was on, and rescued us.
And they were, in fact, just sort of simply crisscrossing back and forth in the South China Sea, right? Looking for boats just like yours.
That's right. So the South China Sea is a big body of water. And so it's really a miracle that they even found us. And so during our trip, there were multiple miracles. One of them was obviously when World Vision Sea Sweep found my boat. But prior to that, when we were drifting out at sea with no food or no water, by day five, my father had his first connection with God. In Vietnam, my family was, we were not Christians. We're superstitious. We believe in Buddhism, Taoism, ancestral worship. And my father had always believed in a higher power, and that there were certain virtues that were, such as generosity, honesty. He believed in doing good, but he certainly did not have a relationship with God. But while we were drifting out there, and he looked around and saw his family of eight children and his wife were just dying from dehydration and starvation. And by this time, we had several people on the boat who became blind. They were hallucinating. And my father got on his knees and just cried out to God. And at this point, he didn't even know the name for God. They just believed that there was a creator. I got on his knees, cried out, said that my family's dying. We need water. And almost immediately, the skies turned dark and rain came down and gave us just enough water to keep us alive until the next day before World Vision's Sea Sweep rescued us.
Talk about that, maybe that experience in the World Vision ship. I know you've got some pictures in the book where, Stan is sort of doing, there was some concern where you could go, even, right, get off that boat, but that became sort of a looking for a home at that point.
Exactly. So it was a very politically tense situation and it was a decision that Stan and the captain of the boat had to make, because with they had, by picking up refugees, they might have found themselves out of commission and without a port anywhere that would accept a boatload of refugees. But they looked at the 93 people who were dying, and they decided to follow their conscience and said that we would do what is right, regardless of all the different political pressures. And so they picked us up and eventually found a refugee camp in Singapore that would accept us.
So you're in the camp in Singapore. You're a family of eight. Were there other family members? Did they all get separated? So were there like cousins or extended family? Because you came out with quite a large group, right?
That's right. So the original group of 290 people included my parents and their eight children. So that's 10 people in my immediate family. There were also a group from my mother's side, about seven or eight people. There were also my father's extended family, his brother, his sister, their children, and then my father's mother as well. After we were on the beach in Malaysia and separated into four smaller groups and towed out, the boat that my immediate family was on, as well as some of my mother's side, were picked up by World Vision. The family members on my father's side all drifted back to Vietnam.
And were they punished as a result of that?
Or? Yes. So they suffered much more than we did, because I don't know the exact number of days, but they faced starvation, dehydration for a longer period than we did. And then the worst, though, was that they returned to a country now where they literally had nothing. And they were temporarily imprisoned and had to start from scratch because they had given up everything when they left the country.
Well, Vin and his family had given up everything and ended up in a refugee camp in Singapore where, you thought at this point you've made it, or your father thought, well, all right, we at least are safe. We're out of Vietnam, and so there's hope ahead, I assume. You were probably hopeful at that point, right?
That's right. So we celebrated for being in a refugee camp. Now, think about that, to celebrate, because at least we knew that once we made it to a refugee camp, we were safe from death and from attacks from pirates. At that point, we still didn't know where we would end up. We could have ended up in any country who would accept us. But as it turned out, there was a small Lutheran church in Fort Smith, Arkansas, a place we'd never heard of before, that sponsored my family. And so after spending about 3 months in the refugee camp in Singapore, we were relocated to Fort Smith, Arkansas.
We'll pick up the story on the American side here in just a few minutes with Vin Chung as he tells the story written in his book called Where the Wind Leads. He wrote it with Tim Downs. It's published by Thomas Nelson. Vin and his family came to America literally with nothing but some moldy clothes on their back, resettled in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and we'll hear about their miraculous story of rescue and redemption. Vin now serves in a private medical practice in Colorado Springs. He and his wife have four children. It's an amazing story. We've got a copy of the book we'll give away. If you'd like to sign up for that, you can call us at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. Or maybe you took in a Vietnamese refugee family at one point, and we'd love to have you connect with us that way as well. Stay tuned. Hey, we're talking about a story of hope and amazing rescue and redemption. It's Vin Chung's story. It's really not only his story, but the story of his family, extended family, and how God has continued to work and direct providentially in their lives. And it's written well in thanks to Tim Downs for helping out. It's called Where the Wind Leads, and it's out from Thomas Nelson. And Vin has several graduate degrees, attended Harvard University and Harvard Medical School, and also has Master's of Pharmaceutical Studies, a Master of Theology, and has told his story in an amazing way, and we're just hearing it. Just before the break, Vin and his family were received in Fort Smith, Arkansas, which I'm thinking probably was there wasn't a whole lot of similarities between Vietnam or Singapore or anything in Southeast Asia.
No, there wasn't. Well, I'll tell you this. That was the coldest we've ever experienced because it was around October that we arrived in Fort Smith. And in the book, we shared about one of our first introduction to this new and crazy culture, at least in our perspective, was crazy. And we arrived a few days before Halloween. And obviously, Halloween is not something we celebrate in Vietnam. This is mostly from my older siblings' memories. They would talk about how they have these kids that knock on our door, and we'd open it, and there are a bunch of kids standing around with masks, and really scary looking masks. And my parents didn't know what to do, so we closed the door, and we're wondering what is wrong with this country. But of course, you know, we learned the game shortly after that, and we eventually began to participate as well. But that was kind of a first introduction to American culture, was kids with scary masks at the door asking for candy.
Because you came, I mean, virtually with nothing. You had the clothes on your back, but no language, I mean, no support really. What was that like to be essentially totally isolated in this foreign land?
That's right. I think for me, I had it easier because I was only 3.5 years old. But my father had a really rough time because, if you can imagine, in Vietnam, he was the owner of a multi-million-dollar business with several hundred employees. And all of a sudden, because of the war, he lost everything. And now he finds himself in a new country, not understanding the culture, not speaking the language. And he looked around and saw that he had 8 children to feed. And so he scrambled and just find whatever work that he could do. And he ended up working various blue-collar jobs, and he spent about 3 decades actually working on an assembly line. And so this was especially difficult considering the successful job that he had in the past in Vietnam.
Which I guess, well, I mean, we hear those stories time and time again. This is not uncommon, right? People that are highly skilled, highly trained, coming from other countries, if they're coming in as a refugee or immigrant, that doesn't guarantee that they're going to find, you know, suitable work for their skills.
Exactly. And you pointed out earlier about my my siblings and my accomplishment. There are 11 kids in the family. We have 21 university degrees from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Georgetown, NYU. We have 5 doctorate degrees and 5 master's degrees. And my youngest brother, when he graduates from dental school at UPenn, will have the 6th doctorate in the family. But all of our success is possible only because of, one, the freedom that we have in this country, and two, because of the sacrifices that my parents made. And in particular, the sacrifice that my father had to make working on an assembly line, doing work way beneath what he is capable of doing. And so that, to me, just illustrates what really needs to happen in order for people to achieve the American dream.
So what was the maybe the passion and the push for education? Why was that so strong? Because you were... you were expected to be a doctor, whether you wanted to be or not, right?
That's right. It's a good thing I like it. I think one is just my father's own personal desire to be a doctor, and he just never had the opportunity because he grew up. His entire life has been filled with disruption, wars, violence, and he just never had the opportunity to pursue it. And in the U.S., we knew that our only way out of poverty, and we were living in poverty. There are 11 kids on a blue-collar salary. We were living in poverty. And we knew that the only way out was education. It wasn't winning the lottery. I wasn't good enough at sports or singing, or we didn't have any amazing talents like that. but we knew that education was the way. And my father and my mother recognized that. And at that point, I think there were times where it could have been perceived as very stressful. But now looking back, I am so glad that they emphasize that for all of their children.
Talk about your early days at school, though, because you, even though you came to America as just a little 3.5-year-old, and language, you didn't talk a lot, right? And language was one of the challenges to assimilate.
That's right. So I remember when I was at school, I was in preschool and they would sing nursery rhymes, and I'll look around, I have no idea what they're singing. I just look at the pictures, there's Mother Goose and there's Humpty Dumpty, but I had no idea. And even to this day, when I, when I read things to my children, I realize, oh, so that's what that nursery rhyme was about. I didn't do very well in English, and I think my standardized test scores was in the 20th percentile when I was in junior high, because there was always that challenge. But over time, with a lot of hard work, I'm doing okay now.
But you did okay in math, though, right?
That's right. And so I think math is one of those things that just came naturally to me. I like math because it made sense, and it is universal. And I think that's also why people like science. It's really something that could be understood regardless of which country you come from, what culture you're familiar with, is universal. And there were absolutes. 1 + 1 = 2. 5 × 2 = 12, which is a lot.
Or 10 if you were using the the American math system.
So
I thought maybe you were starting to just sort of get into the American mode of inflation there and just kind of expand your
existence. That's right.
You're not working for the government now, are you? Just want to check.
No. Thank goodness.
Vin, talk about you mentioned your father crying out to God in the middle of the South China Sea, mm-hmm. and some miracles that happened there. There were some others along the way. Was there a opportunity for his faith to grow and for that faith to be introduced to you? I mean, in your early years living in Fort Smith.
Yes, absolutely. So when we came to the U.S., so first of all, it was as I'd alluded to, the entire world has turned its back on the Vietnamese refugees. But while we're in the refugee camp in Singapore, there was a small Lutheran church that loved a family of 10 that they knew nothing about, and it didn't matter. The fact was that they loved and cared for us, and so they sponsored us and helped us get on our feet. Later on, there was a Vietnamese ministry at a Grand Avenue Baptist Church in Fort Smith that continued to care for my family. And it was through this ministry that both of my parents learned about and accepted Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. And it was through this ministry that all 11 of the children learned about and accepted Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior.
Is there, as you kind of look back on that, maybe talking with the family, were there some things that, were helpful and other things that were not? And what would you, what advice would you give to maybe churches that are, maybe aren't actively involved in caring for refugees?
Sure. I think the first thing is that you need to recognize that regardless of what you do, it will be a little bit cumbersome. It'll be a little bit difficult and challenging. But we need to, first of all, love people who are different from us. You got to love the poor. And once you love the poor, then you gradually figure out what they need and how you can serve them. And so that's probably the first thing. Okay. Because I think if you approach it with your own idea of what they need, it may not be that might not be the case. But instead, it's just you got to love them and try to understand what their needs are before you act.
One of the great parts of your school as you get a little older is you discovered that you could hit people legally.
That's right. It was a wonderful experience. So, you know, as refugees, growing up, I'd always felt like I was a second-class citizen. Even though legally I was in America and I was entitled to all the rights, I never felt that way. And I always, in the back of our minds, we're afraid that we'll do something, get in trouble, and maybe get shipped back to Vietnam. Even though it's not realistic, but in the back of our mind, there was always something there. And so growing up, when there were kids that would call me nasty names or pick fights, I would always have to turn the other cheek. And of course, that's combined with what I learned at church, which is that you turn the other cheek. But it wasn't until a seventh grade when I was introduced to football that I learned that it's okay to hit. And I loved it. And it was liberating, because that was the first time in my life where I felt that I was on a level playing field, that regardless of my skin color, regardless of where I lived, regardless of what jobs my parents hold, I was treated the same as anybody else. There were clear rules. And we were placed in combat, I guess you could say, with someone else, and there were referees and judges and coaches that would evaluate our performance fairly. And so that, to me, was what opened up my own self-esteem and confidence, and to see that if I work really hard, I would get something back in return.
I think it's so helpful just to hear your perspective coming from, you know, another culture. As you said, you felt second class, even though, you know, maybe outwardly, you know, people weren't trying to put that upon you. But just how those opportunities made such a difference. Your family was concerned, though, that your brothers and sisters would stay out of trouble. So your dad bought a restaurant at one point, right?
That's right. So, you know, you'll hear of my family as Vietnamese refugees, and we've done very well. We all focused in school. We all graduated from college. Many of us have graduate degrees. But you also hear about the Vietnamese refugees in larger cities where they end up in gangs and getting in trouble, teenage girls getting pregnant, and all of that as well. And people often ask me, you know, what was the difference? What was the secret? You know, I think there were many folds. I think one was just my parents' emphasis on education. And then two was that we were part of a church that helped us to stay, you know, on the straight and narrow path. And then, of course, is also we were so busy working at our family's Chinese restaurant that we didn't have time to get in trouble. So those are probably three big factors that helped me to be where I am today as a doctor.
There was a point, though, in when you were in high school where you met the girl, and we're going to hear that. We're going to hear that story in a minute, because that brings in a whole another layer of feeling inadequate, perhaps. Huh? So
right.
Hopefully, not still feeling that way. But we're going to get Vin Chung's story. More in just a moment, talking about his stories he's written about it called Where the Wind Leads. Tim Downs wrote it with Vin, published by Thomas Nelson. It's a refugee family's miraculous story of loss, rescue, and redemption. And it's a reminder, again, of God's grace and the opportunity we have to share the love of Jesus in some very practical ways. We'll hear more in just a moment on Connecting Faith. Some miraculous accounts of how God, His providence, protected and cared for a family of Vietnamese refugees. They were set adrift out in the South China Sea, rescued by World Vision, resettled in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And the Chung family of 11 kept busy and pursued education, had a little Chinese restaurant, and then had an opportunity to pursue some special education opportunities, and it was there that he met a girl. Vin, tell us the story.
Well, I think my wife could tell the story better than I can, but I'll just preface it with the fact that I grew up, there are 8 boys in my family, and I have 3 older sisters. They're significantly older than I am, and I had never had a formal conversation with another female my entire life until I met my wife. And we were 17 when we first met at Arkansas Governor's School.
So that was kind of a whole life-change experience, wasn't it? You could actually talk to a girl.
That's right. I could say more than hi, goodbye. And, I think that it was a very awkward, very cumbersome experience. But it was also, I think, a part of me, the relationship part, or I guess the human need for relationship, that part of me really came alive at that point. Because, with 7 brothers where we share the same room, we only grunt and we hit each other. And when I play football, that's all we did. We butt heads or slap each other. But there wasn't any real meaningful conversation that took place. And so I had that for the first time.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're not, sort of butting heads with your wife. I think that's important to clarify.
That's right.
She was a Korean, though, so suddenly there were some kind of values challenges that has developed as the relationship developed, right?
That's right. I had alluded to this earlier about the difference between an immigrant and a refugee. Her father, or I guess her family, came over as immigrants, where they were in Korea, and their goal was to come to the United States for a better life. And when she grew up, it was clear that she had to go to an Ivy League school, and ideally Yale University, and it was her goal to serve on the Supreme Court justice after she graduates from law school. As a Supreme Court justice after she graduates from law school. Whereas my family, we left as refugees, and our goal was just to stay alive and not to be persecuted or to die from starvation. And so when I was growing up, my father had always emphasized education, but the goals were very different. It was more for me to have a decent living, one that's better than his, which was working on the assembly line. But it wasn't to change the world or to do anything great, because we'd never even thought about that. And so when I met her, she really changed my worldview and as well as my ambition.
In fact, you hadn't even considered the possibility of Harvard, right?
That's right. I never did. And I thought that I would just go to a local university near Fort Smith, go to medical school there and come back and live a comfortable life. But after I met her, she challenged me, and then my world finally expanded to beyond what I was used to. And the other thing that was new to me as well was the concept of paying for tuition. It never crossed my mind, because I knew that tuition at any of the Ivy League school was about $30,000. It was about $30,000 a year, which is more than what my father made in his entire annual income. So you didn't have to be a math genius to know that you just can't afford to go there. But I learned early on, and I'm so glad that I did, was that these universities, even though they're expensive, have incredible and generous financial aid packages. And eventually I was accepted to Harvard, and they gave me a very generous financial aid package.
You went on to pursue a doctorate degree, MD, and you studied at the University of Sydney as a Fulbright Scholar. So, you've pursued education time and time again, as you talk about your family. I mean, that's the family reunions must be kind of interesting these days.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I put off getting a real job for as long as I could. when I was in college, we decided to go go live overseas. So right after college, we planned to get married, and I had no skills, and I didn't know what I could do overseas, and so I relied on what I could do best, which was to be a student. And so I applied for the Rotary Scholarship and got a fellowship to pay for my year at the University of Edinburgh. And then came back from medical school, and we did the same thing again with the University of Sydney with the Fulbright Scholarship.
You've been involved with the World Vision now on the board. Looking back, did you have any sense of the impact, the life-changing impact of World Vision then? And maybe what are your thoughts now as you see the work that they're doing?
I am just incredibly grateful and humbled. And I have I'd always thought that I would make a difference in the world, and I'd always believed that I am expected to help the poor, but I'd never imagined being in such a privileged position as serving on the board of World Vision. And the more that I learn about it, the more impressed and confident I am that this is the organization that can really have the longest reach and to be the most effective at combating poverty.
Ben, how do you help your kids maybe understand courage and sacrifice and, you know, diligence and all those kinds of things? I mean, they're growing up in Colorado Springs in a completely different world than what you grew up in.
That's correct. And so, as crazy as it sounds, I am concerned that my kids are growing up too comfortably, because I believe there is a value to have from growing up with adversity. One, I think if you don't have anything, it makes life simpler. Then you could really know immediately what's important. And two, I would like to make sure that my children are always appreciative and to understand that not everyone in this world live in a condition like we do in Colorado Springs. And so what we do is we involve them early on with the work of World Vision. For example, we are doing a run this October called for Team World Vision to raise clean water for people in Africa who don't have it. And they know clearly that every $50 you raise would translate into one person's life that could be changed forever. And so we involve our children in that. They participate in fundraising events. This past month, they had a little lemonade stand in our neighborhood where they had garage sales, and they raised $100. And the incredible thing about this is that other kids in our neighborhood are also influenced by it. And we have kids in our neighborhood now where for their birthday, they don't want any gifts, but instead they want donations to World Vision. And so these are the actions that I will have to be deliberate at to make sure that my children grow up with the same values that I had.
Ben, we only have about a minute left or so. What are you most thankful for today? Or when the word gratitude comes to mind, what pops into your mind?
Oh, there's so many things. I think I am thankful for being in this country. And when you have personal experience living in a world that doesn't have freedom, and you come look at the freedom that we have here, it really is just incredible. And so that among other things, are what I'm very thankful for.
Well, I want to wish you a wonderful 4th of July holiday. I'm sure that's probably a holiday that you have readily adopted and celebrate.
Yes, thank you so much.
Vin Chung telling us his story today. Graduated in Harvard Medical School, also University of Sydney. Has a Master's of Theology at the University of Edinburgh and currently on the board for World Vision U.S. And Dr. Chung and his wife, Leslie, have four children, run a successful private medical practice in Colorado Springs, and you want to read his story, Where the Wind Leads. It's a memoir written with Tim Downs, published by Thomas Nelson. Vin Chung joining us today on Connecting Faith. Hey, if you missed part of the story, you want to listen again, you can check out the podcast by going to myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And then click on the Connecting Faith show page and encourage you to give a listen and hear the story again. And join us tomorrow on Connecting Faith as we talk with Ellie Kay. We're going to talk about finance and fitness, all coming up here on Connecting Faith.